We're continuing a series of lessons, began 2 weeks ago, came down sick last week and had to interrupt it a little bit, and I appreciate those that were able at the last minute to kind of fill in my absence. But we're going to continue, this is what we call the Problems of Evolution 2, and especially for those that are visiting with us, we appreciate your presence, but we need to explain to you. Our task is, for the most part, to preach New Testament Christianity. Not in a modernization of it, but the way it was preached by our Lord and the apostles in the first century, trying to maintain that because that's the gospel that saves. So how do we explain lessons like this? From 2 Corinthians, Paul talks about one of our tasks is to, as he put it, to take on the fortresses of the world, the speculations that are out there, adding the knowledge that God can provide and the facts of the circumstances, and to begin to tear down some of those fortresses that men erect against all knowledge of God. And evolution does qualify as one of those that one of those fortresses that are erected directly against God. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time hacking away at the defenses, I guess, of the things that men have reared up. What evolution has to offer is usually speculation and some pretty artistic reconstructions, which we'll be looking at this morning. However, scientifically, evolution violates many, if not most, of the laws of specific evolution. And the event of evolution itself really could never be proved in a laboratory. Even as they try to come up with different scenarios, it's only possibilities that they can come up with. Even if true, evolution would only be a historical occasion. Now, I could agree with those that want to say, well, let's not teach creation in the science classroom. But I'd go along with also the fact, let's not teach evolution there also, because in the same category, historical events. And they don't fit into a test tube at all. In this lesson, we would like to show you, though, that some of the, we're going to call it pseudo-evidence, false evidence, for the evolution of man and the blatant dishonesty that has been involved in its promotion. And we're doing this to show you that scientists are men, and it depends on what kind of background training they had. Not all of them are dishonest. Many of them actually could care less about evolution. What they learn in the classroom about technologies, and they go and they're very useful in applying them to all aspects of life. But evolution itself, the general evolution, really isn't a science. It's more of a philosophy. In fact, it's even been classified by the Supreme Court as a religion, because you need just as much, if not more, faith in order to believe in evolution as you do to believe in God. And as we've done in the past, we try to provide more evidence, show the evidence for God, that it is a mound more than what is put out there. As for the biblical record to begin with, in Genesis 2:7, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. This is what God reveals to us as to the beginning of our world. There's much to be said of the creationist model over the evolutionary model, and we've done that in the past. The creation by a higher power accounts for how complicated life is especially the human body. Just to look at the wonder phenomenal of the human body, is itself probably the greatest argument that we needed a divine creator and not just thrown together by happenstance. In Genesis 1:27, God created man in his own image. In the image of man, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And that's an interesting point, too, the male and female part. Psychologically, from this, the creation model puts man on a higher level than just another animal form. And what it does then is call us to a higher standard of behavior. If men begin to degenerate, it's not God who's the problem. It's man who's moved away from God. In fact, more recent studies have shown is that when men bought into evolution, primarily it was Darwin's thesis of survival of the fittest that kind of spurred Adolf Hitler to do the things he did in Nazi Germany. More atrocities, you know, people can bring out and say, well, all the things that have been done, the atrocities done by religion, there have been more atrocities committed by man in atheistic societies than religion even dreamed of, even in its worst case. When man is called upon by his creator to be more moral and ethical person, a great plus for people living together in a society. You may think the Christian is just a fanatical screwball, but at least you can trust him. He makes a better neighbor than someone who doesn't believe in God at all and has no standards of morals or ethics. When a person is told he is no more than an animal that clawed his way up from the mud, he will act accordingly. And our society is beginning to reflect this. This fully explains the rise in crime in our own society where God has been taken out of consideration. Also, the Bible record explains why the higher forms come in a set, male and female. You know, even as we show on this thing, you know, you've got the little table of the ascent of man. Where's the table for the ascent of females? In case it escaped your notice, you know, they came in twos. Okay, the biblical account tells us why. Okay, evolution kind of overlooks it a bit. How evolutionary process could produce the two together so that they could reproduce remains an unexplained variable. But more into the problems of just the ascent of man, according to the scientists. And what we're giving you is a bunch of nice little pictures. We'll probably go through these kind of quickly because there's something I want to tag on to the end of this. But just looking at the various, and this is, you know, again, the chart at the top, starting from the left going right, this is the way scientists put these things in the books. Ramapithecus, this is pre-man, as is shown, a little picture of him over to the right, lived supposedly 30 million years ago, one of the first humanoids. Its evidence consists of a handful of teeth and a jaw fragment. After measurements by Dr. Robert Eckhout, it was reported to be just an ape with the same characteristics of the high-altitude baboon of Ethiopia. Second in the line of descent is Australopithecus. I have a hard enough trouble, you know, pronouncing biblical names without going through all these things, but you know, bear with me. This skeleton was discovered in 1924 by Raymond Dart. The name means southern ape. Subsequent expedition was sponsored by the National Geographic with Louis Leakey in charge. It was claimed to be a unique humanoid, so he wanted to keep the funding up. Most workers at the site, though, claimed it was an ape. Even Leakey's son Richard said it was a knuckle walker, and other evolutionists debated that it was a specialized ape like a baboon. Java Man was supposed to have lived 500,000 years ago, founded by Dubois in 1891. It was constructed from a skull cap and a human femur found 50 feet away. Also, the two molars were provided. Two human skulls were found at the same level, so there's not much difference between what this is and humans. But just before his death, Dubois claimed that it was nothing but a large gibbon. The reconstruction shown may look very like a very ancient skull, the thing over to the right, but it is nothing more than a reconstruction. Okay, they didn't find the whole skull. A little note on reconstructions. You'll see two different pictures, one on each side of this little portion, and it's reconstructions of supposedly the same person. Although reconstruction appears to be an exact science, in truth it is very interpretive, like an artist's rendering. The shape of the skeleton is almost impossible to put back together, depending on what you think it is. You know, I mentioned if you've followed the evolution of Tyrannosaurus Rex in the movies, from Ray Harryhausen's kind of him sitting up down and squatting on his haunches, to more like a bird where he's, you know, rearing his up and in the air and he's running around very agile. It depends on what theory you're going by as to how you're going to reconstruct the bones and how the thing walked and everything else. Also, how much fat covers the skeleton? You'll see even in forensic television shows where they take a skull and they begin to, you know, I think they use little erasers, and they'll put the eraser and cut it to a certain depth, supposed to indicate the depth of the fat on the skull. But how do you determine that? How do you know how much this guy ate, you know, during his lifetime? Did he have, you know, fat cheeks, thin cheeks, high cheeks, whatever? It's really kind of, you got to feel your way through it. How much hair can vary as the two renderings show. You know, do you put a little bit of hair on him, or do you put a lot of hair on him? You know, it'll determine how far back you know, people think he came from. Number four, the Peking man, discovered around 1920 or 30s in China, 25 miles from Peking. There's no evidence of this guy. Supposedly there was a mound of evidence. They put it all on a train headed north. The Japanese attacked the train, wiped it out. But there's absolutely nothing left. Patrick O'Connell, a Catholic priest in the China area, was not allowed to see the site, but noted the lack of exhibited artifacts even before supposedly everything was, you know, massacred. He testified the Japanese had never interfered, as claimed, and that the site was a lime quarry where workers used to kill monkeys to eat. That's where all the skeletons came up. Nebraska man, discovered 1922 in Nebraska by Osborne, one of the most eminent paleontologists of that day. Evidence was a single tooth. It turned out that the tooth was that of an extinct pig. Piffdown man, or also called Don man, he supposedly lived 500,000 years ago, discovered in England in 1912 by Arthur Woodward, director of the British Museum, and Charles Dawson, medical doctor and amateur paleontologist. The only evidence was a skull and jawbone. Subjected to tests in 1950, finally, the skull turned out to be treated with iron salts to look old, and the teeth had been filed down. It was a complete hoax by two of the most reputable men you're going to find. My favorite, Neanderthal. Now, they only pronounce it Neanderthal. I don't know why, but it's Neanderthal. Okay, now we're going to be dealing with the first one they found. Supposedly lived 100,000 to 25,000 years ago, first purported to be the missing link. Found in Dusseldorf, Germany, its bent skeletal structure was later attributed to arthritis and rickets from vitamin D deficiency. There was also found next to it a small boy's skeleton that was upright but kept from public view. So the guy, when he unearthed this thing, he wouldn't let anybody examine it for like 25 years. When they finally got around to it, they found out the guy wasn't big bent over because he was an ape. It's because he just had arthritis. The boy, the skeleton of the boy, was completely upright. Wasn't bent in any fashion. And it was kept away in a closet, which they found later. Hence the expression, having a skeleton in the closet. This is where it comes from. That means you're trying to hide something. In order to cover up, more skeletons have been found to establish a Neanderthal man. However, similar-looking men lived only 1,000 years ago. I don't know if you're a fan of Michael Crichton. His first books were, you know, say like his first book had to do with five cases or something like that, because he was a medical doctor. And so pretty much his writing stayed with what was historical facts. The second book I think he wrote was The Great Train Robbery. Again, a historical fact, you know, covering, you know, all the ins and outs of that, that fascinated him. The book I'm referring to now that he wrote is called Eaters of the Dead. If you've seen the movie, it was called The 13th Warrior. Didn't follow the book at all. Okay, but the premise of the book was that there is a diary in existence of a young Arab man. He wrote it about 1,000 years ago. And he was an emissary sent to another, you know, like northern country out of Arabia. And en route, his caravan was attacked by all things Vikings. And so he accounts his journeys while in captivity of the Vikings. And they took him farther north than most Arabs had ever been in their life. And so he quotes seeing these giant monsters in the sea, a whale, obviously, the way he describes it, and then taken into, you know, roughly Norway, that area. And as they're coming in, they encounter a hostile tribe. And the way he describes this tribe, you know, these are kind of brutish-looking people, completely covered with hair. It's a perfect description of the Neanderthal, but it lived only 1,000 years ago. Okay, not hundreds of thousands of years like people want to say. So if they found these kind of skeletons and stuff like that, they don't necessarily have to date that long ago. Okay, we have modern records of people that lived, you know, within, you know, a millennium. Cro-Magnon, the fellow supposedly came on the scene about 35,000 years ago. The problem with this is noted by many, he varies little from common man. You couldn't tell the differences. He was standing in a line at the theater with you. Other fossil remains, such as which are undoubtedly varying degrees of Homo sapiens, include Swanscombe man, Steinholm, and the it's probably a French word with too many vowels. Okay. Fossils. Since carbon dating dates carbon and not calcium, if you find a bone pit, forget about determining the age by carbon dating, because bones are calcium. However, if you do have a campfire or other charred remains, then probably you can get within the area. However, remind you that carbon dating is not accurate after 5,000 years. Lucy. Again, one of my favorites. An obscure anthropologist became famous, and you get famous by getting into something like National Geographic or Smithsonian. Discovered a knee joint to be 3 million years old in a human ancestor. Now, what's interesting of this, if it really dates at that, then, and this was a comment by Leakey at the time, Richard Leakey Jr., is that if Lucy actually existed at that time frame, it goes way back here, which gets rid of this whole chart. It shows, you know, first men appearing way before even the first apes. Okay. So now they got to deal with that. A year later, about 40% of the fossilized skeleton was recovered, about 3.5 feet tall, female, dubbed Lucy. On examination, she bore similarities to both the Australopithecus africanus and the Australopithecus robustus, both of them apes. To further demonstrate how unauthoritative and unethical science can be at times, especially Richard Leakey, he, along with Alan Walker, published a paper reporting the discovery of skull 1470 in East Turkana region of Africa, along with several leg bones. Leakey congratulates Naginio and paleontologist John Harris for making the discoveries. things Antoninus Bernard word for as many hours screening the fragments, his mother Wood, Alan Walker for reconstruction of the material, and obviously relied on others for anatomical analysis since he himself had never been to college and had no professional training in anatomy or anthropology. You got to stop and think at this point, just exactly what did he do? Somebody else found the site, somebody else found the bones, somebody else, you know, did all the classification, all whatever. But his name is listed as the sole author of the paper. The Laetoli footprints. This is an archaeological site in Tanzania, about 25 miles south of Olduvai Gorge. Louis Leakey's widow began work there in 1974. Many footprints have been found of antelopes, pigs, giraffes, elephants, rhinos, hares, ostriches, and other animals dating supposedly from about 3.7 million years ago. The fly in the ointment knows that there were some parent Homo sapien upright walking footprints also. In the artist's rendering, all the animals are placed in their respective footprints except the human footprints. In their place is a depiction of a subhuman half-ape creature, because every evolutionist knows that humans didn't live 3.7 million years ago. Because that's what the charts say. Forget all the evidence, not only at this place, but also the Paluxy River excavation. Or maybe they should look more critically at their strata dating processes. When one looks into the history of mankind, they find that there are over 250 legends about the Great Flood from all over the planet. Nations like China, Greece, India, Africa, and Mexico all have flood legends. One of the great mysteries concerning dinosaurs is the large number of dinosaur graveyards found in places like the Arctic, Canada, Utah, Africa, and the Antarctic. The Great Flood would explain all these nicely and validates the biblical record. I kind of got through that quickly because of something else I wanted to read. A lot of times it seems like sometimes it's hard to know where evolution stands. You know, there are some that go, oh, we're in the twilight of evolution. And others go, you know, we're really coming back hard. You know, secularism is growing in the schools and things. So I found some material. This is by a Dr. DeSouza, former White House domestic policy analyst. He wrote a book, What's So Great About Christianity? It's a book for it, not against it. Some of his observations. The continued growth of religion worldwide has not gone unnoticed by leading atheists. And they express candid puzzlement. You know, why is religion taking off? We've been preaching evolution all these years and religion's getting out in front. Biologist Richard Dawkins confesses that religion poses a major puzzle to anyone who thinks in a Darwinian way. The problem, they presume that religious beliefs are nothing more than illusions. They believe that religion requires a commitment to factually impossible worlds. The question then, why humans would evolve in such a way that they come to believe in things that don't exist. You may have to stop to think about this. You know, from the viewpoint of the evolutionists, you know, forget about creation. If evolution is slowly getting better and we're getting smarter and more reasonable and everything else, why suddenly do we start coming up with all this mystical garbage? You know, belief in heaven and hell and morals and all these things that obviously we can't find among the lower animals. Clearly, the ultimate measure of evolutionary value is fitness, the capacity to replicate more successfully than the competition does. Religion seems useless, you know, amount of time, money, sacrifices, and everything else, but it's increasing at an alarming rate according to evolution. The evolutionary biologist is puzzled. Why would evolved creatures like human beings, bent on survival and reproduction, do things that seem unrelated to these objectives? It seems to cater to wishful thinking. It makes no evolutionary sense for minds to develop comforting beliefs that are evidently false. Biologist E.O. Wilson writes, "We have come to the crucial stage in the history of biology when religion itself is subject to the explanations of natural sciences." He expresses the hope that the final decisive edge enjoyed by science, scientific naturalism, will come from its capacity to explain traditional religion, its chief competitor, as a wholly material phenomenon. That is, you believe in God because your molecules are arranged that way. Yet Dawkins, he suggests that there might be a God module, something in there, in the brain that predisposes people to believe in the Almighty. That's an evolutionary fluke. This is the best they can do. There is no Darwinian explanation. But this guy proposes, how about a Darwinian module that produces belief in evolution? Maybe evolution's the fluke. Imagine two groups of people. Let's call them the secular tribe and the religious tribe. Two different worldviews. Which of the two tribes is more likely to survive, prosper, and multiply? The religious tribe is made up of people who have an animating sense of purpose. The secular tribe is made up of people who are not sure why they exist at all. The religious tribe is composed of individuals who view their every thought and action as consequential. The secular tribe is made up of matter that cannot explain why it is able to think at all. In a comparison of the two on this planet, the religious tribes are flourishing. Religious groups attract astounding numbers of followers, and religious people are showing their confidence in their way of life and the future by having more children. By contrast, atheist conventions draw only a handful of embittered souls. One of the largest atheist organizations, American Atheists, has around 2,500 members. You can get that in one of the churches in the Midwest. Throw a stone in the faculty parking lot of an elite American or European university, and you have a good chance of hitting an atheist. But throw a stone anywhere else in the world, and you're going to have to take aim. The lifestyle of the practical atheism seems to produce listless tribes that cannot even reproduce themselves. The consequence, so predictable that one might almost call it a law, is that the religious population is growing fast, while the secular number is shrinking. Last page, folks. Just bear with me a few more minutes. I hate to be read to also. Not only is religion thriving, but it is thriving because it helps people to adapt and survive in the world. David Wilson argues that religion provides something that secular society doesn't, a vision of transcendent purpose. It provides it helps develop a zest for life. It gives a hopefulness about the future. It forges principles of morality and charity that simply make them more cohesive, adaptive, and successful than groups whose members lack this binding and elevating force. Yeah, this is important. for society. What evolution can't explain. Where do we get things like love and hate and fear and curiosity and charity? You know, that stuff doesn't evolve. You know, there's no lower animals that exhibit any of that. So where does it come from? Do we get something from nothing just by a different arrangement of molecules? The world is not buying into it. Okay? What's happening is, it's a like a phenomenon when you get too intelligentsic about something. Perhaps atheism, secularism thrives in the universities, but it doesn't make it in the home because it has no practical purpose in the home. Just as in China, you've got a communist government, but it only thrives in Beijing. The farther you get away, Taoism is more useful to the farmer. Okay? In India, Buddhism might have been the higher thinking in some centers, but it's Hinduism that goes into each of the homes because Buddhism is more ascetic, more withdrawing from life, more monkish, whereas Hinduism plugs itself right into every man's living. Secularism doesn't do that. So religion is getting more and more popular, and it's not weird religions. Actually, his thesis is that more conservative, traditional value religions are making an uprise. They're the ones you're going to find, making progress all around the world, even in the United States. People are shuffling off liberalism. I'll explain a little bit more of that in tonight's lesson. But folks, we got a chance. God is not losing. In one place he goes, when my word goes out, it will come back, and it won't come back unfruitful. It'll make its way. And it's interesting, we're seeing like a third wave resurgence in the world. When Christianity took on the Roman Empire in the first century, Rome eventually adapted it as the empire's religion and spread it, or helped spread it. But as Rome died, Christianity survived and continued. There's been other times, England became a world empire. And its main religion, again, was Christianity. And it took missionaries into Africa and Europe and all over the place, South America. But then the English Empire began to shrivel. But the Christianity remained. 1900, about 20% of Africa was Christian. Today, almost 50% of Africa is Christian. We're using kind of broad terms for Christian. But this is their adapted religion. Christianity remains and and still grows, even after the physical empires are retreating. America has also had Christianity as its main core religion, and it has sent more evangelists and missionaries and everything out through the world than any other nation. The only one that comes in second is Korea. And now America is waning, but not Christianity. It's been said that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. It's not. Christianity is. Islam is compartmentalized. It's primarily only a Middle East religion. And it's growing only because they're having big families. Whereas Christianity is spreading because of conversions. People understand its value. They can relate to New Testament times. The challenges, the poverties, the sacrifices, it goes along with their families. And it truly is making converts in just about every nation of the world. Even some countries in Europe, of all places, are starting to increase in their faith in God. Don't lose hope in God. Okay? Just because your schools say it's one way doesn't make it the reality. We have to trust that God knows what he's doing. And even if, you know, we lose our country, maybe it's for a good reason. It seems that prosperity and God do not go together too well. People have a tendency, we see it in the Jewish, you know, of the Old Testament. When they got rich, they forgot God. Well, we've got satiated in this country. Maybe a little persecution is what we need, you know, to get off our couches and start reaching out to the world around us. God's going to do it, whether it's us or some minister coming in from Nigeria or India or whatever. Yeah. Christianity is not a white man's religion. It started in the Middle East. And just about every nation on earth is beginning to see just how precious it is and how valuable it is. And they're on fire for it. Keep the faith, keep working, and if there's anything we can do to help you, you know, either increase your own faith, or if you're there, you realize, you know, God does have things to offer over anything the world does. If you want to make your commitment to God, confess him as your Lord, repent of the way you've been living in a secular world, and you want to enter the waters of baptism to have your sins washed away, we can help you this very hour. Begin your service to your Lord. Won't you come as we stand to sing?